this all of a sudden looks higher than it has been, but I've been out of town, so what happens when I'm gone? Okay, so I hope most of you are aware we have an exam Thursday. I sent out a formula sheet that will come with the exam to you this morning. You know, I always, when I send out that email, I'm always a little bit freaked that I'm actually going to send you a copy of the exam. So I like check it 8 times before I trust. That's independent of the sheet that you choose to bring. If in fact you're sitting here and you spent significant time in the last 3 days worrying about what you're putting on that additional sheet that you can bring in, you probably want to think twice about how you're preparing for the exam. Okay? That's actually not so important. You really don't want to put a whole lot on that. What you want to do is do lots of problems and systematically make sure you understand what's going on. I arranged to have this room. Well, I asked for a room. Usually not everybody shows up by any stretch of the imagination, so this is probably a big room, but this is the one they gave me. So I have a Q&A session here at 5 o'clock tomorrow. Usually those go about an hour and a half before people just sort of run out of steam. I'm happy to end it earlier if nobody has questions. Can go a little later if people have good questions at that time. But, well, I guess I can't go super later, depends on whether somebody has something in the room. Anyway, so the spirit of that is you can come in and ask me anything you want to ask. You know, if it's something like, you know, what is question 2 on the exam, that I will not answer. But if you actually ask me a question that turns out to be question 2 on the exam, I will answer it for you. Okay, that's. But the spirit of this is it's less me trying to pull the answer out of you like I might in an office hour or something. But it's just trying to answer things straightforwardly. Does anybody have any questions about exam logistics? Yes. It's okay with me. It may not be okay with you. Bring a calculator. You guys are science majors. You should have a calculator, one that does more than aspect, hopefully, and divide. You need to be able to do trig stuff. You need to be able to do powers of 10 and logarithms and exponentials. I feel completely free to ask you to do those. If you look at my old exams, you may find randomly, sometimes I'll have an exam where you don't need a calculator at all. Sometimes I'll have an exam where you have a calculator. I happen to know that some of you are more in your comfort zone if I give you a problem that has numbers. I prefer things in symbols, and I force you to do some of that, but I understand some of you are more in your comfort zone with numbers, so I actually do try to give you some problems with numbers. My exams usually have a number of problems in different formats, sometimes even like multiple choice, sometimes a little essay, sometimes a problem. Handwritten long problem. So I do that in part because I know that those different types of problems hit many of you in your comfort zones where some of the other types don't. So I try to mix it up. And you'll find that I do that with some degree of inconsistency, but sometimes I may have something of that form and sometimes I may not. But I try. So one of the things on my list is to give you something with numbers. So if I give you something with numbers, you need a calculator. If you set it up properly and you have everything done in symbols and you don't calculate the number, you'll get a lot of the credit because we will do partial credit, but you're not going to get all the credit because I'm asking for the number, so you need a calculator. Full credit means that you do everything I ask for, so there has to be, we need headroom for that. I don't care if it's a graphing calculator or not. but I do, you do need to be able to do some trig and stuff like that. If you have a calculator that's so powerful that if you need to do a quadratic equation or something, that you just plug in A, B, and C and press a button and it tells you the answer, and you just write down the answer so that we don't actually know what you did, you'll get that wrong. Okay? So I want you to demonstrate what it is you're doing. Anything else? Yes?
Use a pen.
And I actually mean that for two reasons. One, it's for your protection. Two is, I really don't want you erasing. We grade partial credit. Why would you erase something? Make it clear what you're doing, but if you do a problem and then you erase it all, we can't give you any credit for any of the crap that you might have done right. Okay? So, and trust me, you can use pen and it can be not so neat, and I can guarantee you there are at least 30 people in the room whose papers are a lot less neat than yours. It's not about being neat, but you do want the grader to be able to actually read what you did. Okay? Anything else? Alright. So we did two lectures, this online thing, yes, last week. Did that go okay? How many of you actually listened to them? Cool. Okay. Did it work for you? It's okay? Alright. Yeah, I apologize. At some level, it's really hard for me to make them interesting after a while if I'm just sitting in a room talking to myself. So, I mean, I'm good at talking to myself, but I just got two kittens because I figured I was doing that too much. I mean, it's one thing to do it if I'm giving you a lecture. It's another if I'm just sitting in the kitchen. So I try not to. So... any questions that come to mind that I haven't answered via email on those lectures that you want to ask? We'll go through some of this stuff. But... okay. Okay, so what we were doing last Thursday, or whenever you listened to it, so we're talking about electrical potential. And you may recall in mechanics that often it was very useful to do problems where you thought about changes in energy. So you could, if someone was sliding down a sliding board, you might use Newton's constant acceleration equation to calculate the velocity at the bottom, you know, forces, and you don't worry about friction. But you could also just know the change of height and analyzing how the energy changes. If you do that, you can look at the change in the potential energy in, because of the height change, and set that equal to the kinetic energy at the bottom. Because gravitation is a conservative force, which means it only depends on the endpoint. And that's a very useful thing to do. So it's not that one way is correct and the other way is wrong. They're both correct, okay? It's just very often one may be easier to do than the other. So we tend to jump off the deep end with this kind of stuff in electromagnetism, and we very often will be talking about changes in energy in a system, and we actually generally refer to that as changes in potential. So we define electrical potential. It's really well defined between two points, and we define it as the amount of work it takes to move a charge from that one point to the other point per unit charge. Work per unit charge means that it doesn't matter what charge I move from point A to point B because I'm dividing it out. So it's a measure of the energy it takes to move this charge from one point to another. If I actually want to turn it into an energy, then I multiply it by the magnitude of that charge and get energy. So this potential difference is what we call it, is a very well-defined quantity. And in Thursday's lecture, we actually calculated the potential difference for a particular system, and the particular system is sort of the simplest. That is, I have a point charge plus Q and nothing else in the universe, and I basically ask, what is the potential difference between points A and B? So that is, how much work does it take for me to take some test charge or repute from point A to point B. And we did that. It's an integral, right? Integral of F of ds, F becomes the electrostatic force, and you do the calculation. When you do it, I mean, I find that I sort of at least get the sign wrong at least about 50% of the time. So it's a pain to do. But when you do it, what you find is the potential difference going from A to B, and it is important. Right, the amount of work it takes for me to shove a charge in from A to B is exactly negative that it takes to go from B to A. So the endpoints are really important, and the ordering is very important. And often you need to step away from it a little bit after you play with numbers and you calculate something. You need to step away from it and ask, does it actually make sense? Particularly, does the sign of the work or the voltage make sense? And very often you can think your way through it. And this is an example of it. I don't need to worry about a formula to know that if I have a positive charge here and I have a little positive test charge at point A, and I want to move it from A to B, I have to do work to move it in because I'm pushing it toward that other thing, right? I'm pushing it along the direction I'm going, it's positive work. So I know that this number has to be positive. Right? So work for you to charge to go in. So I can screw up a sign, and if it comes out negative, I know I screwed up the sign because it makes no sense. So you should ask these questions of yourself because it's very easy to mess up signs in this way. Anyway, when we calculated it, what we found was it is the difference of the quantity KQ over R. And so we're going from A to B, so when we do the difference, it's what you have B minus that at A. So you get this expression, KQ 1 over RB minus 1 over RA. RB is a smaller number, so this is a bigger number overall, 1 over RB, so this is positive quantity. Okay? So this is very, very well defined, because it's between two points. So if you're calculating the potential difference between two points and the direction you're going is established, there's only one way to think about it. And you know, it may not be this sort of radial integral. It might be between two plates, or it might be something. So the integral might be different, but it's very well defined. It turns out that there's, because this kind of thing is you run into it so often, it sort of makes sense to define a convention for the potential in a way that's very useful. So it's a little bit like for height, we have a convention, height above sea level, that we use for lots of things. That may not do you any good if somebody asks you how much energy does it take to go up the stairs of a certain building, right? What you need then is the height difference for the building. But it still is potentially a useful thing to talk about absolute height of a particular place. So in electricity and magnetism, we probably do that more than you do in mechanics. And in particular, we use this sort of spherically symmetric geometry for thinking about it usually. You can imagine if instead of moving it from a finite point A to B, I actually move it from infinity, someplace way out there where RA is infinite, and I bring it in from infinity to the point AB, a point B. And so when I do that, RA going to infinity makes this term go to zero. And now what I have is a term that basically represents how much work it takes to bring the charge in from infinity. And when I say bring it in from infinity, you know, that infinity is some point so far away that the force is zero way out there. And I bring it in all the way to the radius point B. So when I do that, then we talk about the absolute potential. Wow, that's pretty lame. I guess I should put a B here, sorry. It's just a notation, it doesn't actually matter what I call it, but give an example I was doing. So we define an absolute potential, which would be this KQ over RB. Okay, and that's, in doing that, what we've said is that the zero of potential is out of infinity. And that is an arbitrary definition. It is a very useful one that you will run into very often. So keep it in mind. And if you had to just have one that you automatically did, that's the one you want. But you will see examples where the problem is set up differently. Where I define, for example, a plate that's in the problem to be at zero potential. And then everything is done with respect to that, not with respect to infinity. So you have to keep your eyes on that. But this is how one defines, basically, if you talk about the potential, if I were to bring a charge and put it at a certain position relative to the charge being Q, then we would talk about the potential at that point. And you can really think of that as being the actual potential energy, the energy it would take to bring that charge in from infinity and plop it down at that point. Okay, any questions at all? So, just like we've done for forces, just like we've done for electric charges, we now can sort of think about this in a piecemeal sort of way. We talked about what we need when we discuss the potential of a single charge and bringing another charge in and putting it at a certain position. But it could be that we have a universe where we have multiple discrete charges. And now we bring a charge in from infinity and plop it down, say, at point P. What is the potential at point P? And it's an energy thing. So you can think about it as being the energy it takes to bring the charge in and plop it here due to this charge being here, plus the energy it takes to plop it down here due to that charge being there, plus the energy it takes to bring here due to that charge being there. So that's what this sum is, and you're basically just summing over all the discrete charges in here, this KQ over R. This R is not a vector, it's a distance. Because in the problems that we did earlier, it didn't matter where around the charge I plopped the other charge down, because the energy only depends on the distance, the force only depends on the distance. So, this doesn't have a direction, and that's one of the reasons why potential is so valuable to us in electricity and magnetism. Calculations are harder when you have to deal with directions. The other thing you'll notice is that this R is not square. If we were asking for something like a field or a force, then not only do we have to worry about direction, we have this R squared in the bottom, and usually things that get squared are sort of harder to deal with. So very often it's easier to calculate the potential than it is the force or the field. So the potential of a system is the sum of the potentials. The potential can have either sign. If one of these charges is negative, for example, then bringing it in from infinity means I'm doing negative work, right? Not positive. Basically, it's trying to pull the charge in, and I have to exert a force the other way to keep it from accelerating, is the way to think about it. Instead of a discrete system of charges, I could have a continuous system of charge. And so you could imagine trying to set that up. You really can start thinking of it this way, but instead of having discrete charges, you have to manufacture the discrete charge yourself, and you do that by considering only a tiny little piece of the charge, which we'll call dQ. And again, dQ may be some rho dV, so that may give you something to calculate, or depending on what the volume is. If this dQ is specified by this vector R, and you want to know what is the potential at some point P specified by this vector R prime relative to the origin, then this difference vector between these two gives you the vector going from dQ to that point. So this basically plays the role of the R sub I there. And so if you just think about this DQ and you ask what is the potential at point P because of that little DQ being in space and I bring another charge in, it's going to be K times DQ over the distance here, which is the magnitude of that difference vector. To do the potential at this point, that is how much work does it take to bring a charge in from infinity to point P, due to that, the fact that I have all this smeared out charge here by whatever distribution it's given, this rho, then I do it exactly like I did, except now I have to sum up all the little dQs, and that's what we call the integral. Okay. So again, you may have to do an integral over a continuous system to calculate the potential at a certain point. But again,
I have mistakes here. Give me a second.
The magnitude of this is important. As this moves around, this distance changes. But the direction is not important because it's an energy thing, not a force. So remember, energy is a scalar, so you don't need a direction. So this isn't over an R squared like it would be for a field, and it doesn't contain direction. I've taken the magnitude of that vector. So typically, this is easier to calculate. What you'll find in practice is that's not always true. There are certain geometries that you'll see in your problems where this is reasonable to calculate, just as we've done a few specific geometries for the electric field to calculate. And anyway, you can sort of think very often this is a bit easier.
Okay, so maybe you don't care.
I don't know. If you care a little bit. The name of the game is to calculate the forces, because that's really what governs how things move. And in a sense, that's what we're trying to do. If we know the electric field, then we know the force, because we can plot down a charge at that point in space, and the force on it is going to be Q times the electric field. I just said that the potential is often very much easier to calculate than the field, but what's nice about it is you can actually calculate the field from the potential if you can figure out the potential. And you can do that by taking the derivative along the direction in which you want to know what the field component is. So this is the electric field component along direction S, whatever S is. It could be X, Y, Z, R, whatever. This is the derivative of the potential function, whatever it is, when you evaluate it, with respect to that direction. This minus sign basically gets the work and energy to come out the right sign. And as we said, if I move in from infinity, I'm doing work on the charge. So when you think about how that works, that minus sign is important to give you the right direction. Okay? So sometimes the correct route to the electric field is to think about energy and potential and then just take a look. I talked about a little bit in the lecture on Thursday. This can be a fully three-dimensional thing, and we're not going to do it in three dimensions. Anything that I hold you responsible for, we will do in one dimension. But that could be X, Y, Z, or R, or whatever the variable is. Okay? Any questions?
Talked about this a little bit on Thursday. I have some charge, and the potential is kq over r. What that means is that at a fixed radius, all the points are at the same potential. That means if I have a charge here, and I move it somewhere over here, I've done no work because they're on equipotential line.
There's no friction in moving a charge around, in a sense. So it's like gravity in that it's a conservative force. So the conservative force means that you can think about the energy changes only worrying about the endpoints, right? So if you have a kid going down the sliding board and you grease the sliding board so there's no friction, then MGH, the change in the potential energy due to gravity, is equal to the kinetic energy at the bottom. You don't have to worry about anything else. Right? That's what it means to have conservative force. Springs are similar. So you may have gotten really sick of doing springs and gravity problems last semester. And the reason that we do so much with those is because the energy flow is very simple. And in real life, it's a little more complicated. You have friction, you have sound, you have other places for the energy to go. But
anyway, so electromagnetism is a conservative force. Since we're doing electrostatics, I'll just call it that. You may ask me, why am I calling it electrostatics when I'm moving the charge around? This
charge isn't moving. So it has a fixed field out here, and I move this charge within that.
At any rate, because these points are all the same distance away, we say that they lie on an equipotential. Or you could say it's an equipotential surface. So if two points are on the same equipotential surface, it takes no energy to move a charge from one point to another. If I consider points at a different radius, so somewhere out here, and I move a point from here to this other point, those now are at different potentials.
So it takes work to do that. So that's a different thing.
If you ponder the electric field lines that are coming out of this charge, they have radial symmetry. And what you'll notice is that the equipotential line is always at right angles to the electric field lines.
Which should make sense because if you just consider the electrostatic force, if I have a charge and I move it perpendicular to the electric field line, I can do that with no work because the electric field is pushing the other way. Remember, work in physics requires that you be moving along the direction of the force. Right? So, or against it. If I move even one iota with or against the electric field, then I'm doing work. It only depends on the endpoints. So I can do lots of work in here along the way. It's just when I get to this point in the end, if those are on a potential surface, then I've done no network. So for example, here I might do positive work to move this one direction and negative work to move the other direction. But the sum will be zero if it's on an equipotential surface.
You okay with that? All right, so let me do an example calculation potential that may help some of this make sense for you. So we have a coordinate system, and let's imagine that I have a very badly drawn ring, which is centered at the origin. Call this X, and y, z. So negative y is coming out at you, and although I didn't draw it all that well, this ring is meant to be lying in the zy plane, and it's meant to be centered at the origin. So, just imagine that that's... And let's say that on this ring, we have a constant lambda. Sort of distributed around the ring. And the question would be, if I put a point P out here, which we'll say is at a distance x from the origin, what is the potential at point P? And from that, calculate the electric field along the x direction. Now, if you look at this problem and you imagine this charge is all positive, from the symmetry of this problem, the field is going to be along the x direction. So I'm asking you to calculate the field along the direction, which turns out to be that's the total field. There's nothing in the symmetry that's going to give any sort of transverse component to the electric field. So to do this problem, you look at it and go, holy crap, I don't know how to do this, you know, continuous thing. So what do? You consider a tiny little piece of it because you know how to do discrete charges. So if we take a little piece of this, which I'll just say is a ds, so the ds being a little piece of the arc length, it will have a differential charge, dq, which is going to be equal to lambda times ds. You can make it a different problem if you choose to give lambda a dependence on where you are around it. You can change it. But in this case, we said lambda is constant. So little charge that I'm considering, little tiny finite charge, which you can think of momentarily as a discrete charge, is lambda times ds for that little piece of arc length. And that little piece of arc length is the distance r from the point P. And a given part of the problem, which I didn't tell you, is that we'll assume that this thing has a radius of A in the xy plane. To draw it in such a way that you can sort of see the three-dimensional aspects of it. But if you want to look at this, I can imagine putting this charge right up at this point with no loss in generality. Okay, it's no different from having it here. And then the geometry might become a little bit more obvious. Here's R, this distance is A, this distance is X. Okay? And in this problem, the dq's that you want to add up all go around this ring. And all of them will have a fixed r. It will change in its angle like that, but the magnitude of that distance is the same for all the points around the ring. X isn't changing as I go around the ring, and A is fixed as I go around the ring. So there are lots of things that are fixed here. So let's imagine that we have just this little dq, and we ask, what is the differential potential at point P due to that dq? And so with that, we basically use this formula that we would for a discrete charge. That is that it's going to be K dq, dq being the charge, the point charge, over R. Both of them are differential because If dq is a differential of p, so I'm really only considering the differential potential at that point due to that dq. And then if I want the full potential, then I integrate this quantity, k dq over r, over this whole volume. But the volume in this case is really just going around the line of the circle. So to integrate around this volume, I really just want to add up all of those ds's. So I'm going to integrate around the arc length of the circle this quantity. And when I do that, I need to make sure that anything that's variable in that quantity is in terms of the variable that I'm integrating around. So k is a constant. dq is lambda ds. I'm integrating around s. That's the arc length around the circle. And this is over r. R is fixed in this problem, right? As I integrate around the circle, that distance doesn't change due to the symmetry of the problem. I can put it in terms of the other quantities in the problems by rewriting it using Pythagorean's theorem as x squared plus a squared to the 1/2. Like this r is just the square root of x squared plus a squared. And since I'm integrating around the circle, I want to go from 0 to 2 pi a. X and a are both constant, so in this case we don't have some really fancy integral to do. This crap just pulls right out of the integral. Because we're not worrying about directions, in a sense, it's an energy. We don't have vectors. We don't have to worry about the sine theta and the cosine theta that's probably been making your life miserable in the last week trying to figure out how to do these field problems. So life is a little simpler here. The k pulls out, the lambda pulls out. The x squared plus a squared to the 1/2 pulls out, and I am left with the integral from 0 to 2 pi a of just the quantity ds. That integral is just s, evaluated between 2 pi a and 0. So this is k lambda times 2 pi a over x squared plus a squared to the 1/2. Okay with that? That would be the potential. I don't have to worry about direction. It's a scalar quantity. To get the electric field in the x direction, which we also asked for in this problem, you take the negative derivative of the potential with respect to the x direction. So this will be k, there's a minus sign, will be k lambda 2 pi a times minus 1/2 x squared plus a squared to the minus 3/2 times the derivative of the x piece in there, which is 2x. And when you simplify this, you end up with k lambda 2 pi x a over a squared plus x squared to the 3/2 power. And it's positive. So lots of things you can do here to sort of verify that you know what you're doing. One is, if you just think about the direction of the electric field, it's going in the positive x direction according to your calculation. If you look at this ring of charge, if it's all positive, it's going to be pushing
a positive charge here in the positive x direction. So you've got the sign right. You should go through and check the units to make sure that if you're asked for an electric field, that the units you get are newtons per coulomb. For the potential, that's a work per unit charge. So you can ask, is it joules per coulomb? Right. So you should check units. One thing that we can think our way through here, just to check. Suppose we move very, very, very far away from this ring of charge. What's the field going to look like? If I move very, very far away, that ring of charge looks like its point. I know the electric field of the point charge is kq over r squared. Right? So if I move the large x way away from the ring, this better simplify to kq over r squared. At large x, this is much bigger than the a, so you ignore the a, and I have x squared to the 3/2, that's an x cubed. Underneath, there's an x on top, that leaves me with an x squared on the bottom. 2 pi a is the entire circumference of the circle, times lambda gives me the total charge on the circle. So I have k times the total charge on the circle divided by x squared, which is the distance squared. So it works, okay? So you really should go through that kind of process as you're going through. And you never get old and cagey enough that you don't have to do this, no matter how many homework problems you do. All right. I was doing the solutions for your exam that you're taking Thursday a little while ago in my office. And I did the problem. And I thought, oh, well, I'll check the units. And I did, and I found I had blown the problem. And I had to go back and figure out how I made my mistake. So on Thursday, you should do that too. All right? So you shouldn't pass up that opportunity
when it arises. Any questions about this? Let's imagine that I have an infinite plane and that I plaster uniformly a positive charge on this plane.
What will the equipotential lines look like? Planes that are parallel to that plane. How do you know that?
Actually, what did Joey ask?
Just stop while you're right ahead. You were right. Don't admit you don't even know what I asked now. That's right.
You said, what are equipotential?
Yeah, I mean, what are the equipotential lines for this system? Yeah. And so you're saying it would be planes that are parallel to that plane, which is correct. And so then my question is, why? What do you think? Parallel to the electric field. Okay. So by the symmetry of this problem, the electric field lines have to be coming out at right angles to that plane. I mean, imagine if I have a point here, and I have a little bit of charge up here, and I ask, what is the direction of the field? It's going to be pushing it this way. But for every little charge I have here, I have another piece over here, which will push it the other way. So by the symmetry of this problem, if I have this charge smeared up uniformly, and it's an infinite plane, then the only way that the field lines can go is at right angles to this plane, both directions, by the way. That means that if I want to think of what kind of surface would always be perpendicular to those lines, they would be parallel planes to this thing.
By symmetry has to be like so.
Okay, and we'll calculate it in a few minutes, but by the symmetry of this problem, that's the case. Now you may be bothered a little bit, or not. If you ponder this a little bit, it might bother you a little bit, and you're sort of thinking of potential as I move a charge into infinity. How's that going to work here? I mean, I have a plane of charge that goes out from infinity. So this is a case where infinity isn't well defined. And, you know, the potential of infinity isn't really well defined. It's a strange sort of problem. But I didn't actually ask you absolute potential. I asked you what are different potential lines. And there you think about differences in potential. What you want to do is think about those surfaces where if I moved the charge, I would take no work to move it along. And because the field lines are going like so, if I move at right angles to those at all points, then it would be a potential surface. If I take a charge from here and move it over to here, that's going to take work because I'm going along an electric field line or against an electric field line or something. So that means this line and that line are not equipotential surfaces to each other. It will take work at the moment. There is a potential difference between those lines. But this way, there's not. Okay?
So if we would like to calculate the electric field, let's imagine that we make a Gaussian surface that looks like this, all right? And this Gaussian surface, we're looking at it from the side, but think of it as sort of a height, or if you want, a rectangular shape, so that it has end caps. So let's say that each end cap has a has an area A, and I don't know that I need this right now, but why don't we say that this distance is an L and this distance is an L. And by the symmetry of the problem, we know that the electric field is always going like so and like so. And I haven't specified it, but let's go ahead and specify it. Let's say that I have a charge per meter squared, a surface charge density that is sigma. So if I draw this from a slightly different angle, here's my plane, and let's imagine that I have this Gaussian surface that looks a bit like a pillbox or pipe that penetrates at the midpoint through the plane. Okay? And that the end caps have area A. So what we know from Gauss's law, and it's always true, is that the integral of E dot dA through that surface is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught.
In this case, the electric field is always normal to the plane. So that means for the circular part of the pipe, the round piece here, the normals always point away parallel to this plane. The electric field always points at right angles for that. So E dot dA for that round surface, the pipe piece, is always zero. The electric field is going this way. For this end cap, the normal is going out with the electric field. For this end cap, the normal is going out with the electric field.
So the left-hand side becomes 2 times the magnitude of the electric field at that surface, at this position that's given by a distance L from the surface, times the area. Right, E dot dA is E times dA if the two are parallel to each other. And I have that here, and I have that here, so I add them together, and I get 2 times that. Okay? Now, I don't need to know L for this to happen. I sort of set it up by construction, they're the same, but it doesn't come into this calculation. So this is just the electric field. It happens to be at a point at a distance L from the surface at the moment. That's equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught.
If this is a pipe that cuts through the surface, the pipe has sort of an internal area A all the way through. So the charge that's enclosed in that pipe surface is going to be the cross-sectional area of the pipe times sigma.
So this will be sigma times A over epsilon naught. So what we find is that the electric field magnitude is equal to sigma over 2 epsilon naught. You good with that?
Does that bother anybody? I can be an inch and a half away from that surface, and the electric field is sigma over 2 epsilon naught. I can be 34,000 miles away from that surface, and the electric field is sigma over 2 epsilon naught. Does that bother you a little bit? It should bother. Okay, it should. Because the field has no distance dependence, which is sort of unphysical if you stop and think about it. It doesn't make any sense. But the whole system is unphysical because I told you I have this infinite plane. And if I have an infinite plane, then it turns out that I have a field that is constant from that plane out to wherever. Okay? So, it's... You should be bothered a little bit. Get over it, because I already set it up to be non-physical. So, you shrug and say, okay, it's a useful geometry for thinking through things. We'll do something with this in just a second. It's actually useful for a lot more than just thinking through things. If I have a little charged plate, okay, if I get close enough to that plate, like I'm an ant on the plate, it sort of looks infinite. So even though this is a crazy geometry, it actually gives you approximately the right answer in the limit that you're, say, very close to a surface or something like that. So it's actually a very useful thing to know. You okay with that? So let us imagine that we have the plate that we just talked about. Let's say that I have it, and I put it right here. And I have distributed evenly positive charge on this plate. And what we learned just a moment ago is that it will give us an electric field. That looks like this, roughly. It's the same on each side by symmetry, and the electric field is equal to sigma over 2 epsilon naught. Let me do the same thing, except now what I'd like to do is take this plane. And let's say that I put negative charge distributed evenly on it, again with the same sigma as I had for the positive charge. And now you have exactly the same problem, except the electric field is pointing in toward the plane. So if we calculate the field, it's the exact same problem, except the flux is now going in toward the plane. So nothing changes but the direction. The magnitude of this E is going to be sigma over 2 epsilon naught, just like we had earlier. I'm going to go ahead and make that a magnitude. All right. Now, I want to take this piece. And just copy it to another page. And then I want to take this piece. And copy it. And place it in the proximity of the first one. So what I've done is, instead of thinking of these as individual sheets, I now have taken one positive sheet and one negative sheet, and I've put them near one another. For simplicity, we can say that this is a distance d apart, if you will. And now notice, both sheets have electric field magnitude that goes to sigma over 2 epsilon naught. The sigmas are the same by construction. In this region of space, this sheet gives me sigma over 2 epsilon naught pointing to the left. While this sheet gives me sigma over 2 epsilon naught pointing to the right. The electric field is a vector field. That means if I have multiple fields, they superpose vectorially, right? They just add together vectorially. So one is going this way, one is going that way, same magnitude. They just completely cancel out. Over here, the blue is going to the right, the pink is going to the left. They just cancel out. Here in the middle, the blue is going to the right, and the pink is going to the right. So they add together. So what happens is that over here,
I have E equals 0. Over here I have E equals 0. And in here I have E equal to 2 over sigma over 2 epsilon naught plus sigma over 2 epsilon naught, which is just sigma over epsilon naught. And it's going from positive to negative.
So I've created a region in space which is infinite this way, has a width, which is the distance between these two plates, and I have a uniform electric field that goes across, which is equal in magnitude to sigma over epsilon naught. So this turns out to be a really useful geometry that we're going to use for all sorts of things.
You okay with that? Yes.
If you call the space in between, if you consider it enclosed or not, is it in two infinite planes in space where they wouldn't be closed?
Okay, so the question is the space between the plates enclosed? That becomes just lingo, English here, because I'm not talking about a Gaussian surface at the moment. And yes, you might find a word, a problem, which would say, you know, in the region enclosed by the two infinite planes, and then they would mean the space in between. So yeah, you might call it that. When we talk about a Gaussian surface problem, it's really important to understand what we mean when we talk about enclosed, charged, or whatever like that. Here, I'm not currently talking about a Gaussian surface.
Right. Well, even that electric field inside an enclosed space is 0, right?
Now, this isn't a conductor.
So this is like oxygen.
This isn't a conductor. This is these planes could, in principle, be conductors, but this region between them isn't inside a conductor. I have a charge. This is independent of this. They're not tied together. If I tied them together with a wire and they were metal sheets, then the charge would just all cancel out. I'd end up with the electric field of 0 on the inside. I haven't done that. I've plastered a bunch of charge on one, a bunch of charge on the other, and I bring them close, but they don't touch each other, and I don't have a wire connection. Okay.
Okay, so just so you know, very often this particular geometry would be something people would call a parallel plate capacitor. What we mean by capacitor we'll get to in a minute. When I do lines like this, this is parallel. So this, you'll find this is very useful in lots of ways. It's a geometry that will keep coming up through the class as we do different things. So one thing we might do is take such a geometry . Now you might look at this and it might seem confusing. Earlier I tried to sort of draw the charge on each side of the plane, just
to make it look like it's distributed evenly.
If I do that, I'm being particularly anal. What's usually done is something like this.
If it's a conducting plane or something, if I put the positive charge here, it's you can consider it all over that thing, okay? So that's sort of the same thing. Or I could just draw it in such a way that it looks like,
you know, I might just put a plus and a minus, something like that.
They all mean the same thing.
Let's imagine that I have this situation. Then I know that I have an electric field that is uniform in this region of space, and the electric field going from the positive to the negative has a magnitude of sigma over epsilon naught, where I have a sigma smeared here and here. Here it's positive charge, here it's negative charge. So one thing I could imagine doing, if I'm bored, is to take an electron and basically start it at the negative plate and just let it go.
The electron is a charged particle, it has negative charge. So if it's in an electric field, there will be a force on it. Things that have forces on them accelerate. So it will accelerate toward the other plate.
Like so. And you might ask, what is the energy of the electron when it reaches the other plate?
If you wanted to create a beam of particles, you might do exactly this geometry and put a little hole in this plate, and basically you accelerate the particles going through, and some of them just go right through the hole, and you have a little beam of particles coming out. So that's sort of how you make a little particle accelerator if you want to do it. So you might say, all right, I have charge here, charge here, I let the electron go. What's its energy when it gets to the other plate?
So the potential is equal to the work per unit charge. The work is equal to Q times the potential. And that's going to be equal to the kinetic energy gain of the electron. The potential difference is the work per unit charge it takes to go from one plate to the other.
So if I just let that electron go and it gains energy to go from one plate to the other, it's going to gain an amount of energy that's equal to the amount of work it takes to go from one that the plates do on the charge.
So usually what we do is we put the charge on the plates
by using a device that does work to charge and separates it. And that device, we often
could call it different things, but we'll call it a battery. So a battery we usually draw with a long line and a little line.
This one is positive, the long one is positive, and the short one is negative by convention. All a battery does is it's something that sits there that has some chemical process or some other type of process that's going on that basically does a certain amount of work to the charge to separate it. And then if you hook something up to the two poles of the battery, then that charge will distribute itself on those things, and there's a potential difference between those two poles. So if you look at a battery and it says it's a 1.5 volt battery, what that means is that there's a potential difference between those two poles of 1.5 poles. So it takes 1.5 joules per coulomb of energy to go from one pole to the other.
So if we, for a moment, say that I have a 1 volt difference here, then the kinetic energy of this electron, basically, it moves through a potential difference of 1 volt, so it will gain a kinetic energy of 1 volt per coulomb. Or its kinetic energy, I'm sorry, is the charge of the electron times this voltage difference. The charge on the electron is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, which you don't necessarily need to, you're not necessarily expected to know coming into the class, but you'll find this is a very useful thing to know. So you might as well know it. You can always look it up. And then this will be times 1 volt, which is 1 joule per coulomb. So this is a 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules in kinetic energy. So basically, if I let the electron accelerate between the poles of plates which are charged by a 1 volt battery, it will gain 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules of energy. This is not a particularly convenient unit because it's very simple. I have an electron, I have a 1 volt battery. These are things you might always have in lab, but now you get this crazy number, this 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19. So we make up a unit which we call the electron volt, which is called the EV. And that is a unit that corresponds to the amount of energy the electron gains going through this 1 volt potential difference. And so we'll come back to this Tuesday. So.